All right, let's do this. How are you, what the fuckers, what the fuck buddies, what the fucking ears, what the fucksters? I am Mark Maron. This is WTF. Welcome to the show. Today on the show, St. Vincent is here, and she's on tour now. She's in Florida, Texas, and Oklahoma this week. You can go check her out live. She's very focused and poised woman, an artist. I talked to her for a while, and you will hear that conversation. Maybe go back and listen to some of her older stuff and get back into that mindset of where I used to be back when I was blowing my mind on experimental music and art rock and the whatnots. Doing that when I was in high school, listening to the Fripps and the Enos and the Friths and the Hassles and the Residents. For some reason, she pushed me back into that in my mind before I met with her. I did some of that. I did some of that nostalgizing. I nostalgized myself in a sort of like, that was a different time where, I had my hair cut in ways that might have been considered artistic. I wore pants that might have had ankle straps on them, maybe puffy at the bottom. I wore shirts, perhaps, that you couldn't see the buttons of and button them all the way up to my neck. Yeah, I had two earrings in my ear. It might have been that time that I was listening to that music. You know, the commitment to getting the second hole in the ear, that was a fairly provocative and artistic choice. Now I just have these vague sort of slight scars where occasionally be a conversation starter. Not the same as having two earrings in. More like, did you have two holes in your ear? Yeah, I did. Wow, really? Yeah, it's a different time. That's the conversation that happens now around the negation of earrings. What was once a hole for earrings, now just an indicator of a time scrambling for a sense of self and hoping the hoops would make it happen. Those were the days, my friends. Those were the days. I had my niece in town this weekend, and this is not the niece that was out here before. This is the niece that I bought a guitar for, and she's been playing it. But she'd come out, and this is a smarty. This girl's a smarty. She's a smarty in high school. She's applying to colleges, but I asked her, which classes she likes, and she said calculus. She likes calculus. I don't even know what calculus is. Here's how I responded to that. Do you need algebra to know calculus? She said, yeah. And I'm like, yeah, I'm out. Nope, not happening. I don't know what X is. Almost ever. I don't know. She's studying biology. I think I did all right in biology, but she aced algebra. She's that kind of person. She wants to study biology, but she's also doing the guitar thing, and she's kind of into some arts. She has a very limited diet, which was challenging. Few choices, macaroni and cheese, a fish, or a pizza. So even though I'm off the cigarettes, I forced myself to eat pizza, and that was tough. It was tough, folks. Hope you feel bad for me. Forced myself to eat pizza. I take her to the UCB. I took my other niece there to the UCB to see ASCAT, because I'm not a big improv guy, as you know, but I'll go, and I like the structure of ASCAT. I've done the monologues for ASCAT. This is where you have a monologist who comes out and does a story based on a suggestion from the crowd, a personal story, then four or five improvisers riff on the story, then there's a break, then they do a little more monologue, and then the improvisers, riff on that, and it all comes together in the end. And obviously it's hit or miss, but usually it's pretty funny. We were at the UCB, the old one, over on Franklin. But I got to tell you, man, for some reason, both times I was there, this guy, Zach Woods, who I couldn't, like, I'm looking at him like, I know this guy, and he's on Silicon Valley. I guess he's been on The Office and stuff. But he was at the UCB, part of the ASCAP. Both times I saw it, this guy's a fucking genius. He's hilariously funny. And I don't say that about anybody. But I was laughing. I generally kind of like, it takes a lot to get me into the, oh God, I can't stop laughing place. But he did it, and it was awkward to me. Maybe the lack of nicotine is allowing me to have more of that I can't stop laughing place. But Jesus, man, this guy is fucking funny. I don't know what his story is, but wow. Zach Woods. He plays the tall guy. He's a very awkward funny dude on Silicon Valley, but he was tremendous and was a great show. So I nailed that. And on Friday night, that was Saturday. Friday, we went, I wanted to take her to Sarah Silverman's show, and Sarah put me on the show. So my niece got to see me perform with Sarah and Gerard Carmichael, Kirk Fox, and Tig Notaro. And that was exciting. I don't think she definitely liked Tig. And I don't know. I think she indulged me because she was staying at my house. She said I was funny. But very interesting to realize that this girl, this teenager, is much smarter than me in several different ways. And I can't even recommend that she try to get as smart as I am in the ways that she isn't smart. That's being a good uncle. You know what? You're doing great. Nothing I've put myself through is necessarily of any value to you. I hope good luck with your medical career. Don't get swayed away on some other trajectory by insecurity or uncontrollable desire unless you want to live the life of an artist. Oh, you know what? I wanted to do this for my friend Andrea Martin, who I love, who's a comedic genius. I talked to her, okay? I talked to Andrea Martin, and that interview will be up soon, but her book is out already, I should say. It's been out. It's her memoir. It's called Lady Parts. It's available now. And if you want a good holiday gift for a comedy fan or just for yourself, pick up a copy. It's hilarious. She's really one of the funniest people in the world. In this clip, we're talking about how hard it is to sell books, because I've had a couple books. So hopefully this will make it a little easier. Enjoy this clip. And the interview will be up soon. And the book, and this just came out, right?
Yeah.
Lady Parts?
Yeah.
And people liking it?
People seem to. Do they ever tell you they don't? That would be bad.
Are people buying it?
Ah, that's a different story. Those are two different questions.
You're not going to know for about a year.
Is that true?
Who the hell knows with books?
Wow,
I've written books. You just don't know. But the great thing about books is it's out there forever. And then out of nowhere, 5 years from now, people are like, I just read your book. Like, where were you when it came out?
Here's a great thing. Yes, it has been a learning curve for me, certainly, with this book. Because you put your heart and soul in it, as you know. And then, really? 40 million people are buying. Wait, they don't want to hear my precious words that took me like a lifetime to reveal. So first of all, you got to let your ego go. That's number one that I've learned.
Yeah,
books are hard. But I'll tell you what has been gratifying to me. Mm. I really wrote this book thinking that I was reaching a demographic of women over 50, thinking I was talking to them. And the young people that are
comedy
moved
people
by this, or not even coming, I just did an interview with a beautiful young girl. She went to school with my son at Kenyon. She's 31, and she interviewed me for the Hollywood Reporter podcast. And she was, you know, her eyes filled up. You know, young, I don't know what it is. I don't know if it's because I talk about being a young girl starting out, or if it's just truthful and authentic, and people gravitate toward authenticity.
Yes.
But that's been very gratifying. So I have to keep reminding myself of that when I see Lena Dunham on number one, and I'm 19,454 on Amazon.com. Wow, that seems to be really low down the list.
That can change if someone buys two books.
How about that crazy addiction?
Don't look at that.
Oh, that's the word. Bottomless pit of despair. Because
it's
changes.
It's not based on anything.
What is it based on?
It's based on if somebody buys 10 copies of your books, it can go up 10,000 points. Like, it's just based on, I think that Amazon number is just based on per day sales.
Through
Amazon.
Wow.
Like, I think it's really that simple. That, like, it's really just based on, like, if someone went and bought, like, if right now someone went and bought five books, it would go up, like, 200.
Oh, my God.
Don't judge on that.
Oh, no,
don't do
I can't.
That to
oh, no, that's like the chat rooms.
It's the worst.
Those are two places to go.
Have you been there, too?
And Broadway, I have. Yeah,
that's
a disastrous
thing. Come on.
Yeah.
Who the hell is on comment boards for Broadway shows? Old people? And they're mean to you.
No, they're not mean. But
Good.
If you can find anything mean if you comb those things long enough.
Sure.
If you're that desperate, I'm not going to stop until I really read something
that
devastating.
Hurts. That hurts
what
me.
Is that about?
Yeah, I don't know, but I do it. Don't you?
Yeah.
What is it about then?
It's the constant need for valifuckingdation.
Still happening.
What the hell?
Still happening.
That's why I've got to buy Pema Chodron's new book. I'm sure I'm pronouncing that wrong. The Beautiful Buddhist Nun.
Yeah.
And her sales will go up if
yeah,
I do that.
Sure.
But
good
I
point.
Can guarantee you one thing. She's not checking Amazon.com.
She shouldn't be.
No.
It'd be, it'd
she doesn't
be,
need to.
She's not going
to
tell anybody if she is.
That'd be interesting.
I don't know if I would assume that she's not, though.
Yeah.
I mean, some of those people, you know, you don't know what goes on inside, really.
Well, that's the truth. You never really know.
Sure. All those people that are fighting the good fight and seem like real Zen masters, they might be secretly just festering.
Fighting the good fight.
Yeah.
I think that's a great thing to say, actually, because I do feel that sometimes life is a battle and you have to fight.
It's horrendous.
Yeah. Sometimes it's beautiful.
But it's interesting to me that I think that probably speaks to a little bit why that woman at the Hollywood Reporter, a younger woman,
yeah.
would, because, I mean, in terms of women role models and people that persevere despite, you know, all odds, and especially in the business that we're in and continue to work, I mean, it's a very moving story for people. You know, no matter what, you know, that you, whatever you come from,
yeah.
the sort of weird persistence that it takes, whether it's a need for validation or a need to connect or whatever it is. I mean, it's very easy to get defeated in this racket.
Yeah.
Either by yourself or others.
Yeah, it is.
I think most people fall to the wayside because they've lost the fight within themselves to keep moving forward. Talent is a tricky thing, man. And you have it in spades and you've always had it. And it's clear that it manifested itself very, very early. But it was undeniable.
Well, thank you. But I think talent's overrated, actually. Here's what I think kind of keeps people going. The sheer joy and curiosity at what I'm going to create. And I don't mean to be a Pollyanna or undermine the unbelievable struggles people have, because your listeners are going to say, you think that's all it takes? I have a lot of joy about my... Look, I think luck has a lot to do with it.
Yeah.
I think talent,
sure.
perseverance. But for me, it's trying to look at this business as a business, not personally, and try to keep, although I have it in spite of myself, a great excitement, enthusiasm
right.
for
right.
People and things. And
you've always had that?
I have always had that. Yes, I have.
But were there periods in your life where it's like, oh, it's diminishing?
There are great periods where I'm sad or feel lonely or have to struggle with anxiety that I struggle with or... Sure. Look, I had an opening last night of Pippin. I'm talking to you. I have a book out. I'm about to start a movie, Night in the Museum. Look, it's a lovely time in my life.
It's great.
But I had to switch gears at a certain point, Mark. I had to, really, when I reached 65, I'm 67 now, because I was saying no to a lot of things, and it wasn't bringing me any joy. And who the hell cared if I was, so you think people out there are like, oh, Andrea Martin said no to that career offer. Nobody gives a shit what yeah. I'm doing. That's another thing that really keeps you sane. Every time you think somebody's thinking about you, trust me, they got other things to think
themselves.
About. Themselves. Oh my God, yeah. 100%. So that was a relief, reassuring, you know?
It's me and Andrea Martin. Look forward to that interview here on WTF. What else is happening? Let's talk now to the amazing Saint Vincent here in the garage. How long have you been living in New York?
I've been bouncing around New York for probably, what year is it? Probably like 8 years.
Yeah?
Yeah.
And have you seen a change? Because I was there in like the late 80s. And
oh, yeah.
Now it's like, what's going on here?
I mean, I sort of missed, I was just talking about Williamsburg yesterday because my bandmate, Toko Yasuda, was in a band called Enin, which was like part of that whole like post 9/11 New York Williamsburg scene, like yas and TV on the radio.
I didn't know that was like what was it was. There was actually a scene that was like called the post 9/11 Williamsburg scene.
No, it's just their hypothesis that that scene kind of. It's not the scene existed,
right, sure.
but like the media was very excited to shine a spotlight on it.
The AAS, that's I remember them.
Yeah.
They're around. Didn't she just put out a record?
Yeah, she did. You know, I just saw her with David Byrne. She played a solo show at La Poisson Rouge in New York.
That's where I taped my special. That used to be the Village Gate.
Yeah.
Back in the day. I keep saying back in the day like I'm an old guy.
Oh, yeah. No,
I'm sorry.
That's fine.
So Well, your record, I listened to the new record. I listened to all your records. I crammed my life with you. My head.
I'm sorry.
The last, no, well, don't be sorry. I mean, I'd gotten the new record a while back, and I'd listened to it, and I liked it because, you know, you can dance to it in your car. And it seems like it feels like a dance record. Is it possible that it's a dance record in some way?
Yeah, it's kind of a dance record.
It is, right?
Yeah.
Like it reminded me of being at clubs that I was never at when I was younger. It reminded me of like New York clubs. But then I went further back, and then I looked at pictures of you from when you were younger, holding guitars.
Oh, Jesus.
No, I like pictures, like, because now, like, you're, the pictures, it's interesting, just the pictures, the evolution of pictures of you. What? Why are you looking grimacing? Like,
no, it's just, the internet is a cemetery, but nothing ever dies, you know?
That's
like,
right.
Oh, yeah. God, you know?
Yeah, yeah, this active ghosts of you everywhere.
Yeah.
That's a good way to put it. It is a cemetery where everything's on view.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's just,
all the tombs are open.
It's just constant post mortem, yeah.
Yeah.
No, but it's interesting to see that there's this just evolution in how you were presenting yourself. Because now, like, it's almost, there seems to be a very calculated way of how you're like, this is the future and this is me now. What was the evolution of that? What's the new look?
What's the new look? Well, I dyed my hair like a year and a half ago.
Great.
I tried to go like, you know, cool punk rock platinum blonde,
right.
But I totally failed. I missed the mark. My friend came over and did it. I was writing the record in Austin, and my friend came over and did it, and it was like orange. It was horrifying.
Right.
And so it was a series of like mistake after mistake after mistake.
Right.
Yellow, like straw yellow.
Yeah.
And eventually I kind of right around the time of the press photos, I landed on a gray, kind of a purpley gray.
Uh-huh.
But I mean, it sounds kind of more complicated and contrived than it was. It was
right.
Like I was watching The Bachelor and like David Bowie videos from the late 70s, and I was like, oh, that sounds like a good idea.
Which ones?
Well, like the Young Americans tour.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Because that's a funny one, because those videos, like his Dick Cavett performance.
He's so emaciated.
He was.
It's like frightening.
Yeah, yeah.
To see him, like it almost feels like it's like he's like a wisp of a, you know, a person.
Yeah, just a little esper.
Yeah.
Yeah, and that video cracks me up because it's like everybody's in business casual.
Mm-hmm.
It's like just got off the job from the bank, and now I wandered on to the Dick Cavett show.
Yeah.
It's so funny.
It was almost like dandyish, but not.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, he was good at straddling all those lines.
He's
the best.
Yeah, he's the only one, really. I mean, that can continue to do it. Now he seems to kind of be resigned in being an older man.
Well, I thought
is he sick? Do you know?
I don't know, but I thought the story was, I thought that he had a heart attack on stage and
recently.
Then decided, well, I don't know if it was recently, but then decided to retire.
Oh.
I think that that's public information.
No, I heard he was ill, but I didn't know. Like, it obviously, he didn't drop, I guess. Maybe it was a little heart attack, because we would have all known if he fell down and had a heart attack. But I also was a big Bowie fan when I was younger, and it's still sort of fascinating to me how he did that, how he did straddle all that from all these different looks. So he had a big impact on you?
Oh, big time.
All the way back? Like, when was the first ones? Like the first Bowie song where you're like, holy shit.
Actually, my first introduction to Bowie was Aladdin Sane.
Right.
And just that like really totally insane piano playing from Mike Garson.
Right.
Yeah, I think David Bowie said about Mike Garson, he's the best rock piano player, keyboard player, because he's not a rock keyboard player.
Did you work with him?
I did, yeah. Yeah, yeah, yeah. I was in a band called the Polyphonic Spree when I was a kiddo.
Right, so it was you and 90 people.
It was me and 90 people. Yeah. And there was like, Red Bull was really big. I just remember drinking so much Red Bull vodka.
It was like new then.
Yeah.
Red Bull was the thing.
It was the thing.
Yeah.
And you just like get super jacked up on Red Bull and vodka and then go act like a maniac.
Wow. Yeah, and there was like full choirs, right?
Yeah, I mean, I joined in 2005 because I dropped out of school. I was at Berklee College of Music. I dropped out of school, and then I didn't tell my parents, but I moved to New York trying to, I, you know, like doing that thing where you think you're going to go to New York and make it.
Sure.
Of course, you know, even then New York was way too expensive.
What year was that?
That was 2004.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Well, wait, like let's that. Go back. So where'd you grow up?
I grew up, I was born in Tulsa, Oklahoma.
Oof. Yeah.
Yeah. Have you done comedy in Tulsa?
I have once.
Really? Where?
I can't remember if it was Tulsa or Oklahoma City. Where does Wayne live?
Oh, Wayne lives in Oklahoma City.
Yeah, I was in Oklahoma City, but I grew up in New Mexico, so I'd driven through Tulsa.
Yeah. Like, where in New Mexico?
Albuquerque.
Oh.
Yeah. I grew up there from third grade to through high school. So like I'm kind of familiar with the, you know, the Southwest, kind of like Oklahoma, Texas, Colorado, Arizona thing, because I was in the middle of there.
I used to go to New Mexico a whole lot.
Where?
I used to go to Taos, New Mexico, go hiking.
Yeah, it's beautiful up
there.
Yeah,
it's wonderful.
Yeah, I used to go skiing there.
Yeah, too scared to ski.
You're frightened of skiing?
Yeah.
Horses, anything?
Love horses.
But not skiing?
Love horses. In fact, once when we were a little... I don't remember. I must have been like seven. We went to a dude ranch in Colorado. And I, you know, when you're seven, sure. you just fall in love with the horse that you're assigned for the whatever.
With your family?
Yeah, I went with my family.
For like 2 weeks or something?
Yeah, I think it was like kind of one of those sorry for the divorce, like kind of vacations.
So you went with one side of the
family. Yeah, exactly. And I remember just being so enamored of this horse and thinking, oh, I'm going to ride off into the sunset. And so I packed, I got back to Dallas and I was just fantasizing about Silverado.
Oh, who's in Dallas?
That's where my mom and stepdad.
Oh, Silverado, you're fantasizing about.
Yeah, so I got this idea in my head that I was going to go find Silverado and we would just ride off into the sunset. So I packed a little backpack, you know, full of clothes and fruit.
That was the horse's name?
Yeah, that was the horse's name. And then...
That's cute.
But then, like many things, I just forgot about it. And so I had this one day, like 6 months later, I was... my room was just really smelling.
Mm-hmm.
And I found the backpack just full of like fetid fruit. I was like, oh yeah, that dream.
the big plans.
Yeah, that's...
Dude Ranch, that's so weird because that's such a like a Western thing. I think my family went to a dude ranch and I had not thought about it. Tanque Verde Ranch was the name of the dude ranch. Yeah. And all I remember is, finding a dead snake.
Wow.
Yeah, yeah.
And arrowheads. Arrowheads were a big part of life.
Yeah, but you never knew if it was really an arrowhead. I mean, you'd look a lot and, it's kind of like one. You know, there's a lot of rocks that were questionable arrowheads. That was a lot of growing up in the Southwest.
Yeah.
So, all right, so you were born in Tulsa, but how long did your family live in Oklahoma? Because, like, Oklahoma is like some serious cowboy shit.
It's, yeah. I moved to Dallas when I was seven, so my parents divorced when I was three, four, somewhere in there, and then my mom remarried, moved us to Dallas, and my dad stayed in Tulsa, Oklahoma, and remarried and had more kids and stuff.
You got a bunch of half-brothers and sisters?
I do, and step-brothers and sisters.
Wow. So you get along with the folks?
Yeah, my mother's a fucking saint.
Yeah.
She's amazing.
Yeah.
And my stepdad's a really good guy. And my dad is a complicated dude.
What was his trip?
I think at some point he just started to value things that I don't think are that valuable. Like money.
Oh, that shit.
Yeah. So he.
What did he do? What was his thing?
He did. He was involved in. He worked for Dean Witter in the 80s. He's kind of on that trip.
The money trip.
Kind of on that trip.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Nothing tangible. Just money.
Yeah. I mean, he's a brilliant guy.
Yeah.
Anglophile. You know, can recite James Joyce and.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah, he's brilliant, totally brilliant guy.
But, so he's a like hyper-educated appreciator of literature.
Yes, definitely, you know, I'd get like a Kingsley Amis book for Christmas and be like 10, and I'm trying to read this British satire that you have to know about the aristocracy and the whole British culture, and I had no context for that, so it didn't read as satire, and it was just boring as hell.
Right.
I've gone back and reread that stuff, but I get it now. But
it's sort of good that at least he was inappropriate intellectually.
Yeah, exactly. It was instead of a first communion or anything, he got me Bertrand Russell's "Why I'm Not a Christian" and just
thank God, yeah. Or thank not God.
Yeah, yeah.
So there was you didn't grow up with that, because there's like some of your songs, there's some Jesus-y stuff. Well, you mentioned Jesus.
I'm weirdly super into it. I mean, not as a agnostic as a
right.
person.
Agnostic. So you definitely differentiate between atheism, agnostic, and belief.
Well, I'm kind of with Louis C.K. yeah. on that. Isn't the world so much more wonderful if you are open to the possibility of
magic? Yeah.
You know.
Sure. I'm with you. I'm with you. Why close the door?
Why close the door?
Why be that kind of cranky, control freaky kind of person?
Yeah. Yeah.
Who else was I talking to? I can't remember. It was actually Maynard. Maynard Keenan. Yeah, from.
He has a winery.
I know. Yeah. Oh, yeah.
I was at a Whole Foods yeah. in like Milwaukee, mm-hmm. Wisconsin 3 years ago, just, you know, stocking up on hippie shit. Mm-hmm. And like, I saw a little, like they were handing out flyers, like, Maynard will be here giving a wine. And I was just like, what?
Yeah, he's all about it, man. That's his thing now.
But it's Arizona wine, right?
Yeah, yeah. And Jerome. He's up in Jerome. I know. I had him in here, and, you know, I wasn't a huge Tool guy. We ended up talking about when he worked at a pet store. We talked about parrots for 20 minutes.
Wow.
But we were talking about magic and art. That he brought up the fact that it's hard to be a good artist if you don't believe in magic. On some level, which
yeah.
I kind of... Well, yeah, because it is kind of magic, isn't it? But you're hung up on Jesus?
No, not really. It's just it's shorthand mythology. Mm-hmm. It's like everybody knows those stories. And yeah. I grew up in an environment, you know, not my specific family. My specific family is...
In Oklahoma and in Dallas, you're definitely surrounded by it.
Oh, yeah, because my dad's whole side of the family is super Catholic. And... Mm. So there was that,
right.
that side, and, you know, my grandmother had us all baptized, but, you know, there were so many fucking grandkids, because she had 11 kids,
yeah.
so by the time it came around to me, she just kind of like, there's a great story about her, she just baptized me in the kitchen sink with a cigarette in her hand. You know,
how was she legitimate? Could any grandma just baptize?
Absolutely. I mean, hey, when you have like 30 grandchildren,
yeah.
Yeah, you just get it done.
Get the Bible, get the sink.
Get it done.
So that was the Catholic side?
Yeah, that was the Catholic side. And then my mom didn't, oddly enough, she grew up in Tulsa, Oklahoma, but wasn't raised with any kind of religion. And so she's went to Unitarian church and stuff growing up.
Oh, that's pleasant.
Yeah, so it's
the
like
Unitarians.
Just like, hey, how about compassion?
Yeah.
So that's kind of where I
right.
come into.
Well, now there's this whole gutted sort of Christianity. It's like the Catholic tradition is so ornate and deep and mm-hmm. dense. And then like somewhere in Texas, someone's just sort of like, we don't need all that shit. We just need Jesus.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I definitely grew up with, you know, with a lot of religiosity around that. I, you know, I felt like it wasn't the kind of thing that you bring up, you know, people just kind of assume, oh, you're white and you're lower middle class or middle class,
mm-hmm.
you are a Christian.
Right.
That's just what you are. That's what happens.
In Texas. Yeah.
Yeah. Like even a couple of girls from my school who were Jewish converted to Christianity just to kind of like fit in, you know.
Oh, the pass.
So there's a lot of, you know, there's just a lot of assumption, you know, about belief. And I remember being in like seventh grade, and I had a good friend who's such a sweetheart, really sweet person, good mm-hmm. person. And for my birthday, she got me a teen study Bible. And so I started kind of thumbing through it, you know, skimming it, you know, next to like Bertrand Russell and
right, sure.
Martin Amis essays. Like, okay, this is cool. And so I had some questions. I was like, well, what about, because it was more the evangelical bent. And
right.
I was like, well, okay, so what happens, you know, for people who've never heard about Jesus?
Mm-hmm.
And I was like, well, they're going to hell.
That's
you
it.
Know,
that's
yeah.
It.
It was like, what happens to animals? Do animals have a soul? Where are they, you know, they're going to hell.
Yeah.
If they don't, you know, if the dog doesn't find Jesus, straight to hell. Yes.
And then probably there was that moment where you're like, well, hell, how bad could it be?
Yeah. Like, hey.
People who don't know about God and animals.
Yeah,
there.
The puppies, yeah. whatever.
Hell is full of puppies.
Yeah.
Hell is for puppies. Let's make that shirt. But you were never like, because I find that, you know, when I think about it now, like I'm 50 and I'm, you know, I've talked about it on stage a lot about belief and everything. I get it. You know, I get why it must be comforting to believe. Mm-hmm. But if you weren't brought up with it, after a certain point, it's like, that's quite a leap.
Yeah.
You got to, you know, the shit has got to gone pretty bad to get to that point of desperation where you're like, I don't know where else to turn but to magic.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I'm with you.
So do you consider yourself a spiritual person, though, in any way?
I mean, no.
No?
No. I mean, I don't, you know.
You shop at Whole Foods.
Well, on tour.
Yeah, yeah.
I don't, you know.
You got some hippie in you?
In the sense of, like, I make my living, like, creating right. castles in the sky yeah, out yeah. of, you know,
yeah.
ether. So, yeah, yeah of course. Mm-hmm. And I have, you know, I have a sense of that being compassionate is the best way to be, you
right.
know, like that, you know, David Foster Wallace, Kenyon College things. Yeah, like, yeah, okay.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah.
There
that
you
makes
go.
Sense. Yeah.
That, you know, that kind of sums it
There's
up, too.
There's a blueprint, yeah.
Yeah, so, you know.
When did you start playing guitar?
I was 12.
Yeah?
Yeah.
And what kind of guitar was it?
First, I got a three-quarter classical guitar, which
the
I thought
nylon?
Was the nylon string.
Yeah, the little one, yeah.
I thought it was so late. Like, it was one of those things, you know, when your parent is being so... Because we didn't have a lot of money growing up, right. my mom and stepdad, but...
What did he do?
He had some kind of job. He's like a...
Like these vague jobs.
He's an engineer for a long time, you know, like a... When just a really bright guy knows
yeah.
everything about history. And then we moved to Dallas and he immediately lost his job somehow.
Yeah.
I don't remember what... Like Procter & Gamble. I don't remember
right.
what it was, but... So he was doing kind of odd jobs for a few years, and then he started a low rent tax business.
Oh, okay.
I don't even know if he's a CPA.
A strip mall tax business?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
And your mom, how many siblings did you have in the immediate world?
In the immediate, my mom had three girls. I was the youngest of three girls.
With the same pop?
Yeah.
And what'd they end up doing?
They're amazing.
Yeah.
They're my best friends. Yeah.
Really?
Yeah.
All of them, you guys hang out and laugh.
They're fucking rad. They're wonderful people.
You got nieces and nephews and things?
Yeah, I got that. So I spend a lot of time in Texas where they are. Just
Texas.
Like, yeah.
You know, I've grown to like Texas. Like I talk about that on the show a lot about the South and everything, like how like I was adverse to it because
mm-hmm.
it's easy to judge. But but Texas is really its own thing, man.
I fucking love it.
Yeah, there's nothing not to love.
I love it.
When you grow up in New Mexico and you ski and you do things recreationally, you grow to despise Texans
mm-hmm.
because they're always there, over-equipped with the, you know, gaudy outfits and cars and
classic.
Stuff. Yeah, and just sort of like loud and it's sort of like, ugh, go back to Texas. But the more I go there, just the spaces of the place and also the fact that it does have its own thing. And it is sort of initially annoying how people are the pride. The Texan pride is an annoying thing.
Mm-hmm.
But then you realize, like, well, there's nothing like it, really. You know, Texas is...
They've got some draconian shit going on politically,
yeah.
but it's a wonderful place.
What about it?
I don't...
Other than it's home.
You know, like in interviews and stuff, I often get asked about, like, well, what's it, especially overseas, because Texas is sort of
Looked
both
down.
Maligned and exotic.
Yeah.
So,
right.
I, you know, there's just something...
Character.
Also, you know what? People are down to earth.
I think that's true.
People are down to earth. There's no... Even if somebody has money or doesn't have money or whatever... You treat everybody the same way, or at least that's my experience of it.
Well, I think also like I see it in the South too. They're down to earth, but there's a politeness.
Mm-hmm.
They may be down to earth, but there's a lot unsaid, generally speaking.
Right. Yeah. Yes.
and you grow to appreciate. Well, I appreciate you being polite because I know that there's something else going on in there. There's definitely some judgment happening, and I appreciate your down to earth capacity to not dump that on me. And just go talk about me at home with your family. There's that Annie she's a little weird.
Yeah.
But they're not going to do that to your face.
Nope.
Thank you.
Yep.
Yeah. Well, all right. So you're playing guitar at 12 and you got your little nylon string guitar
mm-hmm.
and you're learning how to play guitar so it doesn't hurt your fingers.
Mm-hmm.
And
I traded up pretty quick, though. I traded up for an electric guitar. pretty quick.
What was your first electric guitar?
It was a PV Raptor, mm-hmm. and it was one of those like $150, it's in the case with the, you get the gig bag and the little cord and mm-hmm. the and the amplifier.
The little PV amplifier?
Yeah.
Like the little one?
Yeah, where it, and it has a button on it that says lead, and it's just like the most hellacious.
Yeah, yeah. Distortion.
Fun, so distortion sound. Yeah,
yeah, yeah.
Oh.
Yeah. Well, what were you listening to at 12?
You know, at 12, I was obsessed with Nirvana, Pearl Jam, Steely Dan, Jethro Tull, Led Zeppelin,
yeah.
Jimi Hendrix.
Right.
So sort of like a weird, yeah, it's like a weird cross section of like.
How old are you? Do you say that?
Yeah, I'm 31. I'll be 32 pretty soon.
So you're young. So that was all happening.
I've been on the road for like 10 years. I feel.
All right, so you're beat up. Fine.
I feel Peter Pan like. I don't feel old by any means. But I'm just like.
But yeah, but like just to get, like contextually, like Nirvana was happening. I mean, some of that stuff was happening. When you were 12 or 13.
Absolutely. Right. It was happening before, you know. I was 9 when Nevermind came out.
And oh, really?
10 when Pearl Jam 10 came out.
I was on the Lower East Side and wondering how the world had changed. It was weird when Nevermind came out. You're just walking around and everywhere you just heard, you know, Teen Spirit. And you're like, what the fuck just happened?
Yeah.
Like, well, everything's different now.
Yeah. Yeah, it's crazy. I don't know if anything will ever feel like that again.
It will.
You think so?
If you let it, sure.
Yeah.
It's harder to find music.
But I mean, that kind of sea change, that, like,
yeah.
You know, what happened in my school was that everybody who was wearing polo shirts and a, you know, a
conservative
haircut
right.
was wearing a Nirvana t-shirt and a flannel. Right. And
went to the flannel, grow the hair out a
yeah,
little bit.
Yeah, exactly. Like,
they made it okay.
But it was instant. It was overnight.
Yeah. High school changed for everybody. There was a new click on the quad.
Yeah, totally.
Yeah. So punk rock wasn't in your lexicon at that time?
Not at 12. Yeah. I was like, you know,
Jethro
I was
Tull. That's
I was in the classic rock, you know.
Nothing wrong with that.
I was just there. That's where my brain was.
Well, that's where you take in. I just was realizing that last night. I made this CD for my show.
Mm-hmm.
And it's amazing how like your musical taste. I mean, where else are you going to get it unless you got some weirdo in your family who's going to be like, hey, have you ever heard The Residents?
Exactly.
And, you know, you need one of those people. But even now, since I've gotten back into vinyl, there's just so much music that I have no fucking idea, man. How are you going to know
yeah.
that it's all out there
yeah.
unless some weirdo guides you?
And that's the thing. I mean, that's eventually when I was a little bit older, you know, 13, 14, my mom used to drive me to the CD store.
Yeah.
And you just play the game of trying to impress the guy
sure.
behind the counter.
Yeah, that guy's very important.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
You know, next thing you know, you try to like Zappa, and you know, like
that should be a memoir. I'm trying to
Zappa. I'm really trying.
Who is that guy at the CD store?
You know what? It's funny. It's life kind of circles around. But he his name is Chris Penn, and he ended up being the tour manager / I don't know, co-manager or something of the Polyphonic Spree. He was
what?
Yeah, he was that dude who was like, hey, check out. God, Solex, check out Chibamato, check out, buy this Sonic Youth record.
When
blah,
you were
13?
Yeah, 13,
14. Hey.
That's amazing. And that was in Dallas?
That was in Dallas. Hey, what about Nick Cave? Hey,
thank God for that guy.
Check out PJ Harvey, all that stuff.
Oh.
Like,
do you realize how important he was?
He's massively important. I have to say, not to bring up age, but at this point in life, I keep looking back and just going like, thank God. God for my high school theater teacher who made us read the New York Times every week. Like, thank God for Chris Penn who
right.
hipped me to all this shit that I just wouldn't have. It wasn't on the airwaves, so
even
I
your old man. Thank
yeah,
God for Martin
absolutely.
Amis.
Absolutely, yeah. No, love my pops.
Yeah,
you know
that. But those guys are amazing, and he ended up well because Polly they're from Austin, right? They're
Dallas.
Texan.
They're Dallas.
Oh, they're all Dallas.
Mm-hmm.
So it was all right there.
Yeah.
But you didn't know them when you were in high school.
No, because I was younger. I knew Tripping Daisy, which was the band
right.
that the Polyphonic Spree kind of.
Because they were around.
Yeah, I saw Tripping Daisy, you know, play at Trees, you know, 7 times or whatever.
Trees.
Do you remember that place?
Well, I do remember that place. I think I did a show there.
You did comedy
possible?
At Trees.
Yes.
There's a giant pillar right in the middle of the audience. It's like the worst designed
place. I
think
I did do that when I was touring with, who was I with? What was I doing? A live WTF or something? But yeah, I was there. I was at that place. It's like a famous place.
Yeah.
It was there when you were in high school.
Yeah. Before you, that, yeah.
And they had all ages shows? Or you don't remember?
I don't remember. I don't remember if I had to finagle my way in or not.
So you were a theater girl in high school?
I did. It made me so nervous. I hate it. Like, it was one of those things that I loved it, but I hated it because I didn't like to be on stage. But I loved, you know, hearing about Stanislavski. And it was also kind of like, it was also the, aside from marching band, which is its own.
You didn't do that.
No, I did jazz band.
Yeah?
Yeah.
You played guitar in the jazz band.
I did.
In high school.
Poorly.
Right. Can you read music?
No.
You can't?
I mean, I can like sound it. It's like, you know, first grade level, like sound it out.
But you riff pretty heavy on the guitar because I was listening to your songs. So like with all the you know, the other stuff going on, I can hear the, you know, there's some pretty beefy riffs under there.
There's riffage, yeah. Yeah.
I found it. I was like, oh, I wonder if that's her and that weird sounding guitar. Is it usually?
It's always me. I'm the only one who's ever played guitar on my records. That's like, I feel a little bit like, you know, I mean, there are guitar players who I love, who I'd love to play with at some point, but.
Right. But it's weird because the music you're making is not guitar music per se.
No.
But it's in there and you make it sound different. You know, you like to make the noises on the guitars or make it distorted a bit. And
totally. I just look at it like a noisemaker.
You do?
Yeah.
Was it always that way? Or was there a time where you're like...
No, you know, my uncle's this finger style, a brilliant jazz guitar player named Tuck Andrus. And mm-hmm. he's, you know, he's like a one-man symphony on the guitar, plays these old Gibson L5s and is just a master, like... literal master of his craft. And so I started touring with them and was their tour manager for a little while.
How old were you then?
I was 16 the first time I like...
You were a tour manager at 16?
Well, they worked me into it. You know, I had small jobs at first and then by the time I was 20, I would, you know, go out on tour with them in Europe for 5 weeks and...
Really?
And they're so meticulous, like... We were basically flying every day. There was no sleep. I've never been more tired than when I was tour managing them because they just worked their asses off.
Was it, how many were in it?
The Tuck and Patty. It's a duo. It's just them.
And he plays and she sings, or how's it work?
Mm-hmm. He plays and she sings,
and they have a following.
Yeah. I mean, they had a big record in the early '90s, late '80s, early '90s on Windham Hill Records, mm-hmm. So they were kind of a spectral part of my childhood. They were just like the heroes in the mist until I was 15 and 16 and they saw that I was interested, you know, in music and wanted to kind of show me the ropes.
You got lucky with grown-ups.
Totally.
Because, I mean, like, you, like, given where you come from, it could have gone a different direction.
Oh, my God. I remember when I moved back from, you know, I'd moved back from New York the first time when I really could only afford to stay there for like 6 weeks. And I moved back and my older sister was trying to be totally supportive and sweet. I'd move back in with my parents. She was like, well, why don't you just get a job at Starbucks and try to, you know, save up some money? Yeah, I was like, oh.
But you knew you wanted to do it though, right?
Yeah, yeah. I've
so
always
like it was
to
never going
to
be that.
It was never going to be that, no.
It's hard to explain what the hell that is, that inner commitment to expressing yourself and committing to it, as opposed to just sort of like, yeah, that'll never happen. Like that switch.
Yeah.
It's weird because you can't learn that. It's got to be something you're driven to.
It's just there. You can't have a plan B.
No, exactly. Yeah. But you don't even think of it.
Exactly.
That's the weird thing that people don't get. Like there are people that are sort of like, well, I better take care of this. But people who are like us, you're like, I don't know.
Yeah.
That's not even like, I can't even imagine it.
Yeah.
Thank God. Again, I said, thank God. We're on the fence about it.
Praise him.
Yeah,
just
sure.
Praise him.
Hallelujah. Amen. Can I get a witness?
Yeah.
All right, so let's go through it because it's a pretty interesting trajectory here. So you're running around Europe with your uncle,
mm-hmm.
amazed at his finger picking. Was that daunting to you? Did he teach you tricks? Did he teach you how to play guitar?
We didn't have a lot of formal lessons. I watched him. And then I kind of developed my own finger style because I mostly play finger style.
Really?
Yeah. I play a lot with a pick now, just, you know, depending on the song. But I used to just be like trying to be a finger style, not exactly jazz guitar player, but you know, kind of funky thing.
Right.
So yeah, that's where I mean.
And so you're running around these clubs in Europe, and you're backstage, and what are your tasks?
Well,
did you tune the guitars?
I didn't. Yeah, I did do that. My job was after every flight, I would go and take the gear. You know, he had like a rack gear kind of thing. Uh-huh. I would take it. I would have the VU, the voltage meter. I would test it. Uh-huh. I would make sure that it was working after the flight, that it didn't get knocked around. And then I would go to the sound check, and I would set it up, and I would make sure there were towels and water and whatever they needed backstage. I would interface with the club.
A kid.
Yeah. I mean, you know, I would make sure there were fresh flowers here. If we checked into the room and it was shitty, uh-huh. you know, you go down and say, hey, listen, it's too smoky or whatever. Yeah. It's moldy. We need another room. What else? Like, sometimes one time in Italy, I had to just kind of get up in somebody's face who was being so inappropriate.
Mm. How so?
She was a reporter, and she was super pushy. And
an Italian, a pushy Italian. Go
imagine,
figure.
Imagine.
Yeah.
But it was a funny situation because you know what it's like. I am curious. So when you're out there gigging, do you have time to see people before, after shows? Yeah. Are you a hermit, or do
no,
you?
No, I'll talk to everybody.
So you don't need that like hour before the gig to get centered and do.
No, sometimes I'll actually wander around in the audience.
Yeah?
Before I go on.
And just shoot the shit with people.
Not really. Sometimes I'll just kind of look around. Like, there's some part of me that's sort of like, you know, I don't want there to be this weird transition to stage. I don't want a fourth wall at all.
Yeah.
So I like to kind of like just be present around when they're coming in, or just kind of in the back of the room. And if people see me, they'll be like, hey. And I'm like, what's up?
That is super fascinating. Have you ever had really inappropriate like interactions with people
today?
Give it time. I don't know, somebody just coming up to you and being shitty.
Well, not really shitty. It's hard to read people sometimes, but generally if they're at my show and they're there to see me, or they usually come knowing a lot about me because of the podcast, and you know, they do have a relationship with me, and I have to honor that as much as I can without it. But sometimes that can get a little odd, because they do know me and I don't know them at all. And I'm not that good with boundaries. So a lot of times I'll just sort of like, yeah, sure, man. You know, what's up? And they'll tell me stories and stuff. But not too, like sometimes if people don't know me in comedy, like you get a sense of like, you can read a room, or you think you can, where you're sort of like, that table is going to be trouble. There's a bunch of bros over there and they seem a little, you know, shit-faced already. But a lot of times you're wrong and, you know, but not too inappropriate, no. Mm-hmm. I've had experiences in my life where people have done shit, come on stage or yelled stuff. It happens.
Yeah.
Yeah. Why? What are you referring to?
No, nothing. I was actually just curious because I don't know. I wondered, like, what's your process like to perform? And it's interesting that you, instead of needing that, like, oh, I just have to kind of zero in and focus, you actually need to be around people and kind of warm it up that way. Yeah.
Oh, I like that. Yeah, I like having people around. I don't know what the hell I would do with that hour. You know, I don't take that hour any other point in my life, you know, with preparation. You know, I don't like, I like it to be sort of raw and as intimate as possible. And I don't know what's going to happen. But now as I get older, it's like, that's a little emotionally exhausting. I'd like to just go up there with an outfit and an instrument and, you know what I mean? It's like, and not, this is what I'm presenting you. That's all you're getting.
Yeah.
Is what I'm presenting you. I don't need, you know, I hope you like it. I'm not relying on you for my emotional sustenance. I've created this art. Take it.
Do you rely, I mean, obviously you have to have the feedback of people laughing or clapping or whatever it is, but do you rely on, like, is a big part of your self-worth tied to, you know, I killed last night, or fuck, I bombed last night. Like, do you ride that emotional roller coaster, or do you have a little?
It's not a per laugh thing. It's just a connection thing. You know, if I feel connected, or if the room feels connected, or something happens that wouldn't have happened any other time, I seem to rely a lot on that. Like, to get to a place of vulnerability where I don't know really what's going to happen. I like that. Mm-hmm. It's not the most sellable trait. It's like,
how do you mean it's not the most sellable trait?
Well, I mean, it's sort of like, what do you do? Well, I just get up there and I hope I get open enough for something to happen. That sounds like a great show. What if he doesn't get that open? Well, I got other stuff. But for me, you know.
But is it, I mean, because often there's such a chasm between the objective or the audience's reaction or feeling towards a show and your own subjective feeling about a show. I mean, I'm sure it's happened for you that you walk off stage and you're like, oh my God, that was the worst. And then then people come up after and they say that was, or you have a friend you trust who's like, well, are you kidding? You killed.
Right.
And the inverse is true.
Well, that's why I've learned to keep my mouth shut, because my perception, and this is something that's really on me lately, is like, I don't know what bearing it has on reality. My perception, it's a faulty bit of business. Because all I'm carrying is this, baggage of my own wiring. So I don't know what the hell anyone else feels or, what experience they had. And a lot of times, if you respond out loud to your perception, you're going to deny someone their experience.
Yep. Yeah.
You feel that?
Yeah. I mean, yes, I do. But I also saw a show recently where somebody started the entire show with an apology. And I was just like, man, that's such a cop out. Like,
yeah.
I mean, it's one thing.
Like, what form? Like, well, I'm not feeling it tonight, or like, my dog died this morning.
It was like a little bit of it was like kind of part music, part kind of dance kind of thing. Mm-hmm. I don't want to call anybody out, but this person walked up on stage and said, oh, I'm sorry. You probably are wondering why the hell you bought this ticket. And I was just like, yeah. No, like, no, it's one thing to be afraid or it's one thing to be self-effacing, but that actually is just this weird convoluted self-aggrandizing thing where you're letting yourself off the hook if it's bad.
Yeah, right.
But then you've completely disallowed, and then the audience feels somehow guilty or bad if they enjoy it.
Yeah, or else they're sort of like, well, or else you could, kind of program the audience to immediately say like, well, why'd we come tonight? Maybe tomorrow, we should have come tomorrow. Like, like when people ask you that, what show should we see, Friday or Saturday? I'm like, I don't know.
Yeah.
Well, my thing is like, I don't know what I rely on them for anymore. I'm a little better at accepting, that they like me.
Mm-hmm.
I couldn't really accept that.
And before. A lot of them like you. I love you. I love this podcast.
Well, thanks.
Yeah.
But like when I perform, like I seem like last night I went up and I'm just doing these workshop shows. And I know a lot of people had come to see me do them before.
What does that mean, a workshop?
Well, the way I write material, like I just do a small theater and I just give the theater the money and it's like an $8 ticket. And I just kind of ramble through an hour of shit that I'm trying to figure out.
Mm-hmm.
I'd rather do it there than in a comedy club and just sort of get my people. But like a lot of them have been coming to them, so they know the shit as I work it out. And I asked last night how many of you have seen this and how many haven't. And it was about half and half. So now I'm like, well, what am I going to do for the people that have seen me work this shit out before, and still honor the people that haven't seen any of it, but also give the people that have seen some of it something else. So like I put myself in a mental position like, hopefully I can take some emotional risks. I think that's what I get off on. It's kind of menacing, to sort of like, get that open, go somewhere I haven't gone before. And it's not a matter of improvising like characters or like, but it's literally train of thought, kind of like chasing something down and being open enough to try to get at it. But also if like you come up short, being able to go like, no, oh, that again.
Yeah, yeah, totally.
I don't mind that. I like having the comfort to do that. I don't know if it's something you would do at Carnegie Hall, because that's sort of the difference between doing like an oddball fest. Like I've spent 10 years trying to get more intimate, and then all of a sudden it's like, well, you got to perform for 15,000,
yeah.
and then you got to be like, well, I got to know the shit. What am I going to do? The punchline better be strong so I can pace myself and, be a professional. But it's not satisfying.
It's not satisfying.
It's not as satisfying.
That's interesting.
It's a different thing. It's like, well, I'm glad I managed to, I'm glad I have that skill. I can do a good 15, 20 minutes in front of 15,000 people. I don't see how I'm going to use that skill a lot, but I'm proud of myself. I probably would have fallen apart 10 years ago.
Absolutely.
But I mean, but with somebody like you who has such, specific orchestration of pieces, I mean, what is the reward for you in a live performance?
Well, kind of what you're talking about, this, I often, on guitar, on guitar mostly, I will often reach for things that either I don't know what it's going to sound like when my fingers get there, because I don't, I am good at the guitar, but I'm not so masterful that the magic is gone. Like, I sometimes go, oh, I don't know what that note's going to be. Maybe the, oh, okay. And so it just becomes this like process of discovery and going out on a limb and not knowing if you're going to land it. Like, I've, you know, I've played some shows where I've like joked with the band afterward, like, oh my God, I'm so sorry about that guitar solo. Like, you know, there was one particular run of shows where I had gotten really into Albert King. And I was like, wow.
I was just playing with him today.
No way.
I've been playing with Albert King every morning for the last week.
No way.
That's what I'm doing.
That is so cool.
It's fucking weird.
And he does those bends that you're like, wow. Yeah.
You know where they are, right? You getting them?
No. But I was trying. Uh-huh. But what happened was I just sort of for a couple shows just went into this like sort of hackneyed jam band hellhole. You know?
You kept like, the band going? Like, you know, let's,
yeah,
I'm still
let's go.
Soloing.
Yeah, I'm still soloing. And no, that was a bad experiment. But, you know.
So, all right. So you're touring around with your uncle, and then like you want to be a professional musician. What was the first band?
The first, I played in a lot of bands in high school and
like
college.
What were you playing though?
When I was like an eighth grader, I was playing bass in like a metal band, like Pantera, Maiden.
Really?
Yeah, Metallica.
Uh-huh.
And then I played in.
How'd you present yourself?
You know, I presented myself with, I had braces and a sweater vest and sort of high-waisted jeans that I think were kind of boot cut. and I had long straight hair because everybody had long straight hair. You spend, you know, an hour straightening it in the morning. And I wore my bass up really high.
Mm.
So, I mean, I was pretty I was pretty fuckable.
Yeah.
Yeah.
With the bass up here.
Super high.
Mm-hmm.
You know? Yeah. It was like a purple Ibanez that was iridescent blue if you caught it in the right light.
Wow. Mm-hmm. And you could handle it.
I can handle, well, luckily, some of those bass lines were pretty.
Yeah.
There weren't a lot of notes. Like in the Maiden stuff, there's not a lot of notes.
Right. My ex-wife was a big Maiden fan. We went to see them at, I think at the Hollywood Bowl, maybe.
Was it incredibly entertaining?
Well, I wasn't a metal guy really, but you know, I've gotten more into it now. Like, since I gotten into vinyl, I've sort of like started picking up on all the Sabbath and you know that stuff, and I get it. Like, I like that one song by Maiden, but it becomes a little. It doesn't, that type of guitar playing doesn't equate to soulful guitar playing for me.
Yeah.
It's just not the way I hear
guitar. No, I'm with
guitar.
You. I'm
it's
with
a,
you.
A little too mathematical for me. Like, I'm good friends with Brendan Small, and he's a real noodler, but you know, he's a pretty varied guitar player, but there's something detached about guys who are wizards on that instrument. You know, they can do everything so easily, and it's sort of like, you're not allowed to do that effortlessly.
Right.
Pretend like it's taking something out of you, would you?
You don't get paid per note, yeah.
Yeah, I don't. It's so, well, that's impressive. So you're metal,
mm-hmm.
and then you did some other things?
Yeah, I was in a noise band in college called the Skullfuckers, which was just, it was actually this really cool songwriter who was really Polvo-y, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And if you weren't like bleeding by the end of the set, then you hadn't played a good set.
So you were sort of like, you were at least tapped into that performance art rock thing. Like you knew it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I loved it. And I loved all the like Riot Girl stuff.
Yeah.
I discovered that in my late teens and Big Black and the kind of Steve Albini Chicago world.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I saw him at the Rat in Boston when I was in college.
Oh, yeah?
It was him performing.
Really?
Yeah.
It wasn't Shellac or it wasn't...
Well, maybe it was, but he was fronting it. Like, and I recall that because I met a woman there with a black mohawk and she sort of changed my life.
Really?
It was at a Steve Albini show.
How'd she change your life?
I don't know. She was just tough. And, you know, and we ended up hanging out for, you know, I'm still kind of friends with her. She was a welder and a sculptor and just like this tank of a girl.
Wow.
When she was just like from New Jersey and had a chip on her shoulder. And I think I think she taught me how to fuck, really.
Well, yeah, that helps.
Do you remember that person, that adult in your life? Like it was angry, but it was a lesson.
Yeah.
Yeah. This isn't about you. I'm not done yet. That's where I learned that.
Oh, good. I'm glad you learned that lesson, hopefully, early enough on.
You got to have those people.
Yeah.
I mean, those are like, I don't, you know, as you get older, it's sort of like you realize just how far you've come when you see people and you're like, did we, what town were you in? Like, where do I know you from?
Really?
Yeah, maybe. I hope you don't have that issue.
I don't.
Good.
Yeah, I don't. I mean, it's
well, I've lived in 4 different cities over 3 decades. So, like, if someone comes up to me, I'm like, you're going to have to give me a town. You're going to have to give me a city or a period of time because
oh,
I can't.
Oh, man. I mean, if people even, if you even see somebody out of context, like, oh, I met this person in Cincinnati and then all of a sudden they're in New York, mm-hmm. you know, and they say, hey, how are you? It's like, I don't, what?
Yeah.
You know, it just takes a second. It's yeah. a little processing power. Yeah.
Where? What? All right, so you're playing in bands. So when do you become, when does this Berkeley thing happen?
I moved to Boston when I was 18. I left Texas and went to Berkeley, and I dropped out after like 2.5-3 years.
But your parents are supportive of your thing, your trip, all the way through?
Yeah, I mean, my mom especially, because, you know, her brother Tuck is a musician. Mm-hmm. So it wasn't like, it was a family of doctors, and mm-hmm. they said, well, you want a what?
I mean, right, right, right.
I'm sure they had some trepidation, but...
Yeah, it's usually just fear of, you know, like, well, what are you going to do if it doesn't work out?
Yeah.
I mean, that's usually their fear of supportive parents of musical or artistic people. It's not that they don't want you to do it. They just don't know how you're going to make a living.
Right.
But they sent you to Berkeley.
Yeah, they did. Yeah, yeah.
Well, what went wrong there at the noodling school?
I don't know. I got some things out of it. You know, I like dug deep into, they had a great listening library and I dug deep into a lot of stuff.
Like
know?
What?
I mean.
What changed you there?
Stravinsky.
Really?
Yeah.
That is deep.
Yeah.
I don't know anything about that stuff. What about classical music in general? Because now that you mention it, I can hear something building in your records. It's a build to it.
I have, you know, just enough knowledge to be effective, mm-hmm. but not too much to get too in my head about it.
But there is something about the bands you're involved with Polyphonic Spree and with the one after that. Which one were you in?
Sufjan Stevens.
Right. Mm-hmm. And I hear it more in pop music, and I never noticed it because I didn't pay attention to it when it was happening. But I talked to Jack Antonoff in here.
Oh, he's a sweetheart.
He's great.
Lovely guy.
But like, you know, when I listen to that fun stuff or even Bleachers, he's still a very talented guy, that guy. But there is something that comes from Polyphonic Spree that's sort of big. It's like, you know, it's massive. It's a massive sound. But then if you really track it back to classical, I mean, that's all of it.
My artistic trajectory has been slightly one of editing
mm-hmm.
and getting more, like just going, oh, is this absolutely necessary? Because if I wanted, I could fill up every second with a melodic idea or a, you
do
know,
you
I,
want to
no mm. I don't I just
do you fight that though
well I mean I do in the sense that I could
mm-hmm.
I have this melody could go here and this could go over that and then but eventually I mean I just want to write great songs. I just want to be a good songwriter. And so it's always kind of a balancing act between trying to do that and then also, you know, merge it with some of the other
stuff. How does the song start when you're writing?
All number of ways.
I don't know how to write songs.
You don't?
Not really. I listen to songs, but I've never been like a word guy innately.
Really?
Yeah.
You're a comic.
Yeah, but I just like music. Like a lot of times, like there's songs I've listened to all my life and I don't know what the fuck they're saying.
It's so interesting how many people just don't listen to lyrics.
No, I don't know why.
Yeah.
Does it upset you? You mad at
me? Not at all. I mean.
Like I listen to your lyrics because I'm focusing. I want to know what you're thinking. And so I paid attention. And still, like, you know, I don't know where they come from, songs. And I don't know, like, the how people commit to certain songs. But they're great songs. But it's like, if I looked at it on paper, I'd be like, nah, I'm not going to do that.
Really?
Yeah, I just, like, I don't know. I guess, well, I'm not a fucking musician. I'm not a songwriter. So, like, there's something about, like, you can't just be clever. Like, you know, I listen to country songs or blues songs. They're very simple, but you're doing something elevated. There's some poetics to it. And there's, you know, they're vague enough to create emotions without really knowing what the hell it's about. I mean, that's the real gift to it. I mean, it's like, you know, you're conveying feelings and, you know, and I can feel them. But if I were to sit there and look at the words, you, not unlike poetry, you'd be like, what is this about? Where's she coming from?
Yeah.
But that's that must be the joy of discovery in writing, is that, like, you know, you're putting things together, you're having feelings, you're having impulses, even if they're based on an event or, you know, a relationship or a friend or whatever, they have to remain somewhat, not unlike poetry, vague enough to convey feelings about everything to everybody.
Yeah. You have to leave enough room for right. people to put themselves in.
Right. So, and you're aware of that.
Yeah. Yeah. And, but also, you know, you just have to rely on the fact, it's the same thing that I'm sure you rely on, which is that so much of experience is just universal. So even if you kind of pull a Law and Order and change the details,
right.
still the story resonates. Or sometimes it's not even about some literal narrative story that you have to follow to right. the end. It's just like, oh, there's something about the sound of this word
right.
and this melody that is evocative, and
right.
like that's the magic that
right.
I mean, I don't know why it is, but if you just kind of have to trust that if you're feeling
but
something,
like,
then other people will
right. So, like, even like I'm trying to think of what song on the new record is, like, kind of got me. What's Prince Johnny about?
Prince Johnny, yeah, that started out as a short story.
Yeah.
I didn't have any music for it.
Right,
it was just words, and it's sort of a, like, kind of a composite of a bunch of people and one specific person in mind, but then sort of details taken from other parts of this, like, downtown New York,
yeah.
like, music,
right,
free queer
right.
scene.
Yeah, that's what,
and
I felt.
Yeah,
felt all those things.
Yeah, and, you know, wild.
There's a little darkness
nights.
To it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, there's that, you know, everybody has that impulse to self-destruct, and it becomes clearer when you sort of see it in someone else. You go, like, oh, I want to save you. I can't save you. I'm not even the person to save you because I'm insane too, you know?
Yeah. But you don't strike me as the kind of person that's going to let it go.
Let what go?
All of it. Self-destruct.
I've had some dark ones, but no, I don't think I'll kill myself. Is that what you mean?
Sort of. I mean, but just lose control of it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, like any, you know, red-blooded American, I've considered suicide.
Well, no, but I mean, just like, you know, self-destruct to me, that, you know, when your lifestyle is one that is gambling with that, a lot of times people can't stop it, but to some people, it's a romantic venture. So, you know, but some people have that, and it's not, it's sort of a curse, but it's a gift. And there are people on the sidelines that are like, are concerned, but envious.
Hmm. Do you, forgive me, but are you sober, or did you?
I'm sober, yeah.
You're sober.
Yeah.
Yeah.
For like 15 years, yeah.
Yeah, congratulations.
Oh,
I knew that, I wasn't totally certain, because I saw, we walked past your...
Yeah.
In your kitchen, and I saw a glass of like a bottle of champagne. I was like, oh.
That's I think that's cider or something. This is it was Schwag from a, like,
it was.
I have, like, I'll have a couple beers in the fridge. If, you know, you wanted a beer, you could have a beer.
Tell me more.
I don't generally offer.
No,
it.
But no. I mean, but, you know, it's a funny thing. I've been thinking a lot about this as of late, because I stopped looking at the internet. I stopped, you know, except for checking my email and
mm-hmm.
answering calls, and, you know, calling my mama or whatever,
mm-hmm.
you know, call my sisters. But I stopped, like, looking at, this is maybe shameful, but I stopped looking at news. I stopped looking at you know, culture sites. Mm-hmm. I just stopped.
Mm-hmm.
I read a book. I read the New Yorker. I answer my, you know, business emails. And there's something that has happened in the past, I want to say 3 weeks, that, and I don't know if these things are correlated, but I suspect that they are. I'll be somewhere. I'll be, you know, I'll be at a party and end up talking to the New York City cop who's, you know, guarding a velvet rope table full of assholes, you know, mm-hmm. and I just start talking to this guy and he's awesome. Mm-hmm. And he has the best stories. And it's just, people have been kind of giving me their life stories as of late. And I don't know if it's something in me that's changed where people think, hey, this is a person who's receptive. And I don't, and it's not like a, you know, I'm not naive. It's not like they're, you know, flirting with me. Mm-hmm. And we're just talking. Yeah. You know, I had talked to the guy who was, I was in Miami yesterday, talked to the driver for the hour to the hotel. And we just had a really beautiful moment. He told me all about his life, and his son passed away 2 years ago. And, you know, it's just, I think these things are correlated, because usually I would be, oh, what's going on? And, you know, let me check out the New York Times. And I just stopped. And I feel like crazy, this like crazy new kind of compassion and connectivity with the world and with people that I think I just didn't, I wasn't as open to before somehow. And I don't know what changed, but.
Well, it's all very self-involved. I, you know, in the sense that you can constantly distract yourself with something and feel like you're doing something beneficial.
Yeah.
But a lot of times it just distances you. It sure makes complete sense. But I mean, when you deal with people, getting back to like the self-destructive thing and the heartbreaking story of like in music, I mean, God knows. I mean, if you've been at it for, you know, if you've been on the road for 10 years, you see the toll it takes on some artists, and you see the, you know, that some people get lost.
Yeah, it's easy to get lost.
Yeah.
It is.
But you've never been a person that's like, kind of like, oh, God, I got to pull back. I got to check in. I got to.
No, because I mean, sometimes, you know, because I have like a really rad group of girls on tour, like yeah. my bandmate Toko and my production assistant, Rachel, and lighting lady, Suzanne, who was with Nirvana and Sonic Youth yeah. and Stereo Lab. And it's just
She's
a rad veteran. She rules. Mm. But like occasionally we'll be like, I don't know, should we housewife? And it's 3 p.m. and it's like, yeah, let's have some white wine.
Yeah.
So, I mean,
that's it.
Yeah, that's like that. But, you know, 3 p.m. to 2 a.m. Like
right,
you're
right.
still drinking oh, right. for sure. 11 hours, sure.
That's
you know,
a,
so
yeah, full on extreme housewifing.
Yeah, exactly. But but the thing is, you live in such ambient spaces. You're like, you travel, you travel, and it's not like I've been in four cities in 5 days that are completely unrelated to one another. New York, Miami, Dallas, Los Angeles.
Yeah.
And it's like, I'm existing in the ether. Sometimes I don't want to be fully present for that.
Right.
That's the.
For the travel.
Yeah. I don't want to be, you know.
You just want to see the stage and get on.
Yeah.
How's your following? Good?
Yeah, I think it's great. I mean,
you're pulling crowds?
Yeah. I think I have really nice fans.
What's the breakdown? What do you see out there when you look out there? Who are they?
It's pretty varied, which makes me really happy.
And you think this new album has done a lot of it or no?
I think this new album, it definitely, you know, took me to some different level. But it's hard for me to know these things because I'm just living it. I'm just in it.
What about your relationship with David Byrne?
Oh, I love him.
How did that happen?
We met at a charity thing in 2009. He came up and he told me that he liked my video for Actor Out of Work. And then we saw each other at another charity thing a couple nights later. And for this...
in New York.
Yeah. Housing Works is a bookstore.
I know that
charity.
Place.
You know it. Yeah.
Yeah.
And so we were watching Bjork and the Dirty Projectors do a night of like original music. And they raised a bunch of money for charity and it was great. So the Housing Works people asked us if we wanted to do it. And we said, sure. And we started writing. And then five songs, ended up writing an album, ended up being, you know, a year and a half of tour.
Yeah, I listened to it, and like I loved him, you know, and I sort of like there was a time in my life where I listened to all his stuff and even the more abstract stuff, you know, mm-hmm. Catherine Wheel and the Bush of Ghosts and all that. Like I was in it.
That's a great record. Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I'm a big Eno head, and it's interesting to hear like you know listen to your solo stuff and then listen to what you two do to each other, because it's a little different, but it's the same world in a way. But he's not as complicated as you are, it seems.
As complicated?
Yeah.
Really?
Yeah, it seems like there's like it seems, it's weird about Byrne. It's like, he's just a groove guy in some ways.
Yeah, he's very buoyant.
Yeah, yeah, and there's a bounce to it, but it's like there's a simplicity to it kind of always. And did you find that, what did you do to each other musically?
I think... probably I brought some melancholy and he brought a lot of buoyancy.
Right. Yeah.
And it was also fun to play those shows because we had eight brass people on stage and 12 people total on stage between me and David and the drummer and all that. And it made people happy. Like, yeah. I know it sounds so stupid, but I've never like considered like the St. Vincent show, like making people happy. I mean, I want it to be an experience. I want us to like go somewhere together and all the stuff that, you know, probably sounds very trippy and hippy dippy, but I want that. But I never assume that like people are going to the show to just kind of kick back, have some white wine, and have a good time. Like, I don't, you know, I just assume that it's something people go for some other reason.
Right, to be moved somehow.
Somehow. And I don't know if that sounds self-aggrandizing. And like,
No, I think that, like, you know, there's a tone to people, you know, and I never thought about, but that is what Byrne sort of evolved into. I mean, somewhere after he started listening to Brazilian music, it became this different thing, you know, and then it was sort of like, come on, let's, you know, clap your hands.
Yeah.
It was a little easier. Whereas, like, some of the earlier Talking Head stuff was, like, menacing in a way.
Yeah, way more anxiety. Right. I mean, just full of, you know, manic street preacher, not the band, but you know, the archetype. Yeah, I love him. I love him. I go see shows with him all the time when I'm in New York, and we just go do art culture things just on our bicycles.
Well, that's what, I had this weird moment with him that, there was two that I had with him. I don't know him. I think we're probably very different. There was one where I was on a plane with him, and you know, he was in first class. It was years ago, and we land in New York, and everybody's waiting at the baggage claim, and there's no bags coming out. And then, like from over at another baggage claim, I just hear some voice go, "Over here!" And I turn around, and Byrne does this with his hand, like he waves people over, but it was so Byrnean.
Yeah,
like,
there's
something so specific about his movements. I was like, that's amazing.
I know.
And then there was another time where I was just on the street. I think I was out in front of Louis' old place in Chelsea, and he rode by on his bike, and he had lights on his bike.
Yeah.
Right. And there was just something to me where I didn't say anything to him, but I saw it was David Byrne and it registered. And then I just watched the lights kind of fade away. And because it was David Byrne, it had some, you know, poignant thing to me, the minimalism of it. There was an art to it.
Absolutely.
Just the lights on David Byrne's bike fading into the distance.
Yep. Yep. Uptown or downtown or whatever. No.
Well, this melancholy thing, though, you evoke that because I can feel it, and it's something that Bowie does. It's something that Kate Bush does. It's something that, you know, that type of like that ether you talk about. That ether seems to be filled with a type of melancholy. You like it.
I just know it, and I just think you can't write about things you don't know.
Mm-hmm.
It's not like you have to put down your literal life into every song, but
is it hard for you to have a good time?
No, I'm a fucking laugh riot.
You're fun, girl.
No, one of the wonderful things about alcohol for me is, I'm not a horrifying drinker by any means, but like, you know, some people, like, they have a drink and they get kind of weird, and then all this weird dark shit starts coming out, and you're like, I wish you hadn't had that drink. I'm a delightful drunk.
Oh, good.
Yeah, I'm just happy.
And you can manage it.
Yeah.
Did you have alcohols in your family?
I'm Irish Catholic, so,
it was around. Yeah. Because you seem like the kind of person that, like, in that kind of environment, either they're going to go boozy or they're going to go like, nah, I'm in control of things.
No, nobody. I mean, I enjoy it.
Nice.
A little white wine.
Okay.
Housewifing.
Okay. All right.
I don't.
And didn't you do a couple? Did you do an episode of Portlandia?
Yeah, I did.
Like just one or two?
I did three.
You like acting?
Yeah, I do.
Yeah?
Yeah. I'm less scared of it than I was in high school.
Oh, good.
Yeah.
And it's different in front of cameras as opposed to a live audience doing Bye Bye Birdie or something.
Yeah, right.
And, you know, you got a bunch of creative people around you, so it's nice.
Yeah, it's nice.
You can do more of that?
Maybe. If somebody asked me to, I'd do it.
Yeah?
Yeah.
Well, you and Kara are your friends, and she's going to rock out soon again, right?
It's great. It's, and, like, everybody's killing it. Like, Janet's drumming her ass off. Corinne is, like, nailing it. Carrie's playing the most crazy, awesome, outsider art guitar you've ever heard.
But, like, it's funny with her because, you know, we've talked before, and we see each other, and I don't... Like, I knew the band a little bit, but I didn't know it a lot. And we did some event, and I sort of know her as this comedic personality now. And that's sort of my real experience with her as a person. And we did this event for the IFC Upfronts, and she got up there. And it's just a very interesting thing to talk to her. But then when you see her put a guitar on, you're like, oh, well, that's what it is.
Mm-hmm.
That's what's supposed to be happening. Mm-hmm. You know, like she lives on her, you know, like it's just organic thing.
Yeah.
Do you guys jam?
Yeah, we have jammed.
Like just jam out? Do your Albert King licks?
Yeah, I do. No, actually, we've jammed. She has a little, like, you know, they have a little rehearsal-y room.
Yeah.
And what I think usually works best, because she's such a cool extemporaneous guitar player.
Yeah.
My favorite thing about her playing is she's not afraid to go anywhere. And she always ends up in some place really cool that I never would have ever
rhythmically or just
rhythmically, melodically.
Yeah.
And so it works best if I'm on drums and she's, we wrote a couple songs one time that I thought were really cool, but
what
we
happened
never,
to them?
I don't know, they're in GarageBand somewhere.
Well, why don't you guys do a record?
I mean, she's pretty busy. I'm pretty busy.
Yeah, I should do a record.
Well, we could do like a 7-inch. Like that would be fun, but like put it out under, not like be like, oh, it's Stevenson, but like, but put it out like.
Just make up some weird name and don't really say who it is. And
yeah, that would be fun.
All right. Well, I'm going to hold you to it.
Yeah.
Kind of. You should do it. Yeah, you should play drums on it.
She should play drums?
You should play drums.
I'll play drums on it.
Are you a good drummer?
I've terrible technique, but I have good time.
Oh, that's the most important thing.
But past a certain BPM, I'm worthless. Worthless.
So there's definitely a St. Vincent groove on the drums.
Get me around, you know, 100 BPM. Mm-hmm. I can keep it. You know, little swampy bottom. But anything above that, and I'm just a woefully underprepared.
All right. Well, we'll stick with the swampy bottom then.
Yeah.
Nice talking to you.
Nice talking to you.
That's it. That's our show. Christmas is approaching. Are you ready? Are you ready for Christmas? Are you ready for the Chanukah? Are you ready for the other holidays?
I'm not being exclusionary. I just don't know them all. I just, I think it's, you know, I know they're Christmas and Hanukkah. Kwanzaa, is that time? Maybe I shouldn't even talk about it. Happy holiday. How about just that? Are you ready for the holidays? Hey, look, folks, get on the mailing list. I always forget to tell you that. If you go to WTFpod.com, not only can you get JustCoffee.coop, not only can you get the premium app, you know, get the free app, then get the premium app and stream everything, but get on the mailing list. I spend a lot of time keeping up with you people.
I sit it on Sundays and I write you a nice letter, a nice email about my life and things. So go to the pod, go to WTF Pod, and get on the mailing list, and I'll email you every week. It's not all business, man. It's it's just, hey, what's going on? Wasn't St. Vincent great? All right, let's do a little guitar. Boomer Lynn!